in a garden far, far away. Even should we find another Eden, we would not be fit to enjoy it perfectly, nor stay in it forever. Henry Van Dyke. Mac followed Sarayu as best he could out the back door and down the walkway past the row of firs. To walk behind such a being was like tracking a sunbeam. Light seemed to radiate through her, and then reflect her presence in multiple places at once. Her nature was rather ethereal, full of dynamic shades and hues of color and motion. No wonder so many people are a little unnerved at relating to her. She obviously is not a being who is predictable. Mac concentrated instead on staying to the walkway. As he rounded the trees, he saw for the first time a magnificent garden and orchard somehow contained within a plot of land hardly larger than an acre. For whatever reason, Mac had expected a perfectly manicured and ordered English garden. This was not that. It was chaos in color. His eyes tried unsuccessfully to find some order in this blatant disregard for certainty. Dazzling sprays of flowers were blasted through patches of randomly planted vegetables and herbs, vegetation the likes of which Mac had never seen. It was confusing, stunning, and incredibly beautiful. "From above, it's a fractal," Sarayu said over his shoulder with an air of pleasure. "A what?" Mac's mind was still trying to grapple with and control the pandemonium of sight and the movements of hues and shades. Every step he took changed whatever patterns he, for an instant, thought he had seen, and nothing was like it had been. "A fractal, something considered simple and orderly that is actually composed of repeated patterns, no matter how magnified. A fractal is almost infinitely complex. I love fractals, so I put them everywhere."
"Well, looks like a mess to me."
Sarayu stopped and turned to Mac, her face glorious. "Mac, thank you. What a wonderful compliment." She looked around at the garden. "That is exactly what this is. A mess. But," she looked back at Mac and beamed, "it's still a fractal, too."
Sarayu walked straight to a certain herb plant, plucked some heads off it, and turned to Mac.
"Here. Papa wasn't kidding at breakfast. You'd better chew on these greens for a few minutes. It will counteract the natural movement of the ones you overindulged in earlier, if you know what I mean."
Mac chuckled as he accepted and carefully began to chew. "Yeah, but those greens tasted so good."
His stomach had begun to roll a little, and being kept off balance by the verdant wildness he had stepped into was not helping. The flavor of the herb was not distasteful. A hint of mint and some other spices he had probably smelled before, but couldn't identify. As they walked, the growling in his stomach slowly began to subside, and he relaxed what he hadn't realized he'd been clenching. Without speaking a word, he tried to follow Sarayu from place to place within the garden, but found himself easily distracted by the blends of colors. Currant and vermilion reds, tangerine and chartreuse, divided by platinum and fuchsia, as well as innumerable shades of greens and browns. It was all wonderfully bewildering and intoxicating. Sarayu seemed to be intently focused on a particular task, but like her name, she wafted about like a playful, eddying wind, and he never quite knew which way she was blowing. He found it rather difficult to keep up with her. It reminded him of trying to follow Nan in a mall. She moved through the garden, snipping off various flowers and herbs and handing them to Mac to carry. The makeshift bouquet grew quite large, a pungent mass of perfume. The mixtures of aromatic spices were unlike anything he had ever smelled, and they were so strong, he could almost taste them. They deposited the final bouquet inside the door of a small garden shop that Mac had not noticed before, buried as it was in a thicket of wild growth, including vines and what Mac thought were weeds.
"One task done, and one to go."
She handed Mac a shovel, rake, scythe, and a pair of gloves, and floated out and down a particularly overgrown path that seemed to go in the general direction of the far end of the garden. Along the way, she would occasionally slow to touch this plant or that flower, all the while humming the haunting tune
that Mac had been captivated by the evening before. He followed, obediently, carrying the tools he had been given, and trying to keep her in sight while wondering at his surroundings. When she stopped, Mac almost ran into her, distracted as he was looking around. Somehow she had changed, now dressed in work clothes, jeans with wild designs, a work shirt and gloves. They were in an area that could have been an orchard, but not really. Regardless, the place they stood was an open spot, surrounded on three sides by peach and cherry trees, and in the middle was a cascade of purple and yellow-flowered bushes that almost took his breath away. She pointed directly at the incredible purple and yellow patch.
"Mackenzie, I would like your help clearing this entire plot of ground. There is something very special that I want to plant here tomorrow, and we need to get it ready."
She looked at Mac and reached for the scythe. "You can't be serious. This is so gorgeous and in such a secluded spot." But Sarayu didn't seem to notice. Without further explanation, she turned and began destroying the artistic display of flowers. She cut cleanly, seemingly without any effort. Mac shrugged, donned his gloves, and began raking into piles the havoc she was wreaking. He struggled to keep up. It might not be a strain for her, but for him it was labor. 20 minutes later, the plants were all cut off at the roots, and the plot looked like a wound in the garden. Mac's forearms were etched with cut marks from the branches he had piled in one spot. He was out of breath and sweating, glad to be finished. Sarayu stood over the plot, examining their handiwork.
"Isn't this exhilarating?"
"I've been exhilarated in better ways."
"Oh, Mackenzie, if you only knew. It's not the work, but the purpose that makes it special. And it's the only kind I do."
Mac leaned on his rake and looked around the garden and then at the red welts on his arms. "Sarayu, I know you are the creator, but did you make the poisonous plants, stinging nettles and mosquitoes too?"
Sarayu seemed to move in tandem with the breezes. "Mackenzie, a created being can only take what already exists and from it fashion something different."
"So, are you saying that you..."
"Created everything that actually exists, including what you consider the bad stuff. But when I created it, it was only good, because that is just the way I am."
She seemed to almost billow into a curtsy before resuming her task.
"But then why has so much of the good gone bad?"
Now Sarayu paused before answering.
"You humans, so little in your own eyes. You are truly blind to your own place in the creation. Having chosen the ravaged path of independence, you don't even comprehend that you are dragging the entire creation along with you."
She shook her head, and the wind sighed through the trees nearby.
"So very sad. But it won't be this way forever."
They enjoyed a few moments of silence as Mac looked back toward the various plants that he could see from where they were standing.
"So, are there plants in this garden that are poisonous?" "Oh, yes. They are some of my favorites. Some are even dangerous to the touch, like this one."
She reached for a nearby bush and snapped off something that looked like a dead stick, with only a few tiny leaves budding from the stem. She handed it to Mac, who raised both hands to avoid touching it.
"I am here, Mac. There are times when it is safe to touch, and times when precautions must be taken. That is the wonder and adventure of exploration, a piece of what you call science, to discern and discover what we have hidden for you to find."
"So why did you hide it?"
"Why do children love to hide and seek? Ask any person who has a passion to explore and discover and create. The choice to hide so many wonders from you is an act of love that is a gift inside the process of life."
Mac gingerly reached out and took the poison twig.
"If you had not told me this was safe to touch, would it have poisoned me?" "Of course. But if I direct you to touch, that is different. For any created being, autonomy is lunacy. Freedom involves trust and obedience inside a relationship of love. So if you are not hearing my voice, it would be wise to take the time to understand the nature of the plant."
"So why create poisonous plants at all? Mac handed back the twig.
Your question presumes that poison is bad, that such creations have no purpose. Many of these so-called bad plants, like this one, contain incredible properties for healing, or are necessary for some of the most magnificent wonders when combined with something else. Humans have a great capacity for declaring something good or evil without truly knowing.
Obviously, the short break, which had been for Mac's sake, was over, and Sarayu thrust a hand shovel at Mac, picking up the rake.
To prepare this ground, we must dig up the roots of all the wonderful growth that was here. It is hard work, but well worth it. If the roots are not here, then they cannot do what comes naturally and harm the seed we will plant.
Okay. Mac grunted as they both got down on their knees alongside the freshly cleared plot. Sarayu was somehow able to reach deep under the ground and find the ends of the roots, bringing them effortlessly to the surface. She left the shorter ones for Mac, who used the hand shovel to dig under and pull them up. They then shook the dirt from the roots and threw them into one of the piles that Mac had earlier raked together.
I'll burn those later.
You were talking earlier about humans declaring good and evil without knowledge. Mac shook another root of its dirt.
Yes, I was specifically talking about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
The tree of the knowledge of good and evil?
Exactly. She seemed to almost expand and contract for emphasis while she worked. And now, Mackenzie, you are beginning to see why eating the deadly fruit of that tree was so devastating to your race.
I've never given it much thought, really.
Mac was intrigued by the direction their chat was taking.
So was there really an actual garden? I mean, Eden and all that?
Of course. I told you, I have a thing for gardens.
Well, that's going to bother some people. There are lots of people who think it was only a myth.
Well, their mistake isn't fatal. Rumors of glory are often hidden inside of what many consider myths and tales.
Oh, I've got some friends who are not going to like this. Mac wrestled with a particularly stubborn root.
No matter. I myself am very fond of them.
I'm so surprised. Mac smiled in her direction. He drove his shovel into the dirt, grabbing the root above it with his hand. Okay, then. So, tell me about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Well, this is what we were talking about at breakfast. Let me begin by asking you a question. When something happens to you, how do you determine whether it is good or evil?
Mac thought for a moment before answering. Well, I haven't really thought about that. I guess I would say that something is good when I like it, when it makes me feel good or gives me a sense of security. Conversely, I'd call something evil that causes me pain or costs me something I want.
So it is pretty subjective, then?
Yeah, I guess it is.
And how confident are you in your ability to discern what indeed is good for you or what is evil?
To be honest, I tend to sound justifiably angry when somebody is threatening my good, you know, what I think I deserve. But I'm not really sure I have any logical ground for deciding what is actually good or evil, except how something or someone affects me. It all seems quite self-serving and self-centered, I suppose. And my track record isn't very encouraging either. Some things I initially thought were good turned out to be horribly destructive. And some things that I thought were evil, well, they turned out.
He hesitated before finishing his thought, but Sarayu interrupted.
Then it is you who determines good and evil. You become the judge. And to make things more confusing, that which you determine to be good will change over time and circumstance. And then beyond that, and even worse, there are billions of you each determining what is good and what is evil. So when your good and evil clashes with your neighbor's, fights and arguments ensue, and even wars break out.
The colors moving within Sarayu were darkening as she spoke, blacks and grays merging and shadowing the rainbow hues.
And if there is no reality of good that is absolute, then you have lost any basis for judging. It is just language, and one might as well exchange the word good for the word evil.
I can see where that might be a problem.
A problem?
Sarayu almost snapped as she stood up and faced him. She was disturbed, but he knew that it was not directed at him.
Indeed, the choice to eat of that tree tore the universe apart, divorcing the spiritual from the physical. They died, expelling in the breath of their choice the very breath of God. I would say that is a problem.
In the intensity of her speaking, Saryu had risen slowly off the ground, but now, as she settled back, her voice became quiet but distinct.
That was a great sorrow day.
Neither of them spoke for almost 10 minutes while they worked. As he continued digging up roots and throwing them into the pile, Mac's mind busily worked to untangle the implications of what she had said. Finally, he broke the silence.
"I can see now that I spend most of my time and energy trying to acquire what I've determined to be good, whether it's financial security or health or retirement or whatever. And I spend a huge amount of energy and worry fearing what I've determined to be evil."
Such truth in that.
Remember this. It allows you to play God in your independence. That's why a part of you prefers not to see me. And you don't need me at all to create your list of good and evil. But you do need me if you have any desire to stop such an insane lust for independence.
So there is a way to fix it?
You must give up your right to decide what is good and evil on your own terms. That is a hard pill to swallow, choosing to only live in me. To do that, you must know me enough to trust me and learn to rest in my inherent goodness.
Saryu turned toward Mac. At least that was his impression.
Mackenzie, evil is a word we use to describe the absence of good, just as we use the word darkness to describe the absence of light, or death to describe the absence of life. Both evil and darkness can only be understood in relation to light and good. They do not have any actual existence. I am light, and I am good. I am love, and there is no darkness in me. Light and good actually exist. So removing yourself from me will plunge you into darkness. Declaring independence will result in evil, because apart from me, you can only draw upon yourself. That is death, because you have separated yourself from me. Life.
Max sat back for a moment.
Wow, that really helps. But I can also see that giving up my independent right is not going to be an easy process. It could mean that in one instance, the good may be the presence of cancer, or the loss of income, or even a life.
Yeah, but tell that to the person with cancer, or the father whose daughter is dead. Mac postured a little more sarcastically than he had intended.
Oh, Mackenzie, don't you think we have them in mind as well? Each of them was the center of another story that is untold.
Mac could feel his control getting away as he drove his shovel in hard.
But didn't Missy have a right to be protected?
No, Mac.
A child is protected because she is loved, not because she has a right to be protected.
That stopped him. Somehow, what Saryu had just been saying seemed to turn the whole world upside down, and he was struggling to find some footing. Surely there were some rights that he could legitimately hold on to.
But what about rights are where survivors go, so that they won't have to work out relationships? But if I gave up, then you would begin to know the wonder and adventure of living in me.
Mac was getting frustrated.
But don't I have the right to complete a sentence without being interrupted?
No, you don't. Not in reality. But as long as you think you do, you will surely get ticked off when someone cuts you off, even if it is God.
He was stunned and stood up, staring at her, not knowing whether to rage or laugh. Saryu smiled at him.
Mackenzie, Jesus didn't hold on to any rights. He willingly became a servant and lives out of his relationship to Papa. He gave up everything, so that by his dependent life, he opened a door that would allow you to live free enough to give up your rights.
At that moment, Papa emerged down the walkway carrying 2 paper sacks.
She was smiling as she approached. "Well, you two having a good conversation, I assume?" She winked at Mac.
"The best. And guess what? He called our garden a mess. Isn't that perfect?"
They both beamed broadly at Mac, who still wasn't absolutely sure he wasn't being played with. His anger was subsiding, but he could still feel the burning in his cheeks. The other two seemed to take no notice.
Saryu reached up and kissed Papa on the cheek. "As always, your timing is perfect. Everything that I needed Mackenzie to do here is finished. Mackenzie, you are such a delight. Thank you for all your hard work."
"I didn't do that much, really. I mean, look at this mess." His gaze moved over the garden that surrounded them.
"But it really is beautiful and full of you, Saryu. Even though it seems like lots of work still needs to be done, I feel strangely at home and comfortable here."
The two looked at each other and grinned. Saryu stepped toward him until she had invaded his personal space.
"And well you should, Mackenzie, because this garden is your soul. This mess is you. Together, you and I, we have been working with a purpose in your heart, and it is wild and beautiful and perfectly in process. To you, it seems like a mess, but to me, I see a perfect pattern emerging and growing and alive, a living fractal."
The impact of her words almost crumbled all of Mac's reserve. He looked again at their garden. His garden. And it really was a mess, but incredible and wonderful at the same time. And beyond that, Papa was here, and Saryu loved the mess. It was almost too much to comprehend, and once again, his carefully guarded emotions threatened to spill over.
"Mackenzie, Jesus would like to take you for a walk, if you want to go. I packed you a picnic lunch in case you get a little hungry. It'll tide you over till tea time."
As Mac turned to accept the lunch bags, he felt Saryu slip by, kissing his cheek as she passed, but he didn't see her go. Like the wind, he thought he could see her path, the plants bending in turn as if in worship. When he turned back, Papa was also gone. So he headed toward the workshop to see if he could find Jesus. It seemed they had an appointment.
Wade in the water. New world, big horizon. Open your eyes and see it's true. New world across the frightening waves of blue. David Wilcox.
Jesus finished sanding the last corner of what looked like a casket sitting on a table in the workshop. He ran his fingers along the smooth edge, nodded with satisfaction, and put the sandpaper down. He walked out the door, brushing the powder off his jeans and shirt as Mac approached.
"Hey there, Mac. I was just putting some finishing touches on my project for tomorrow. Would you like to go for a walk?"
Mac thought about their time last night under the stars.
"If you're going, I'm more than willing. Why do you all keep talking about tomorrow?"
"It's a big day for you. One of the reasons you are here. Let's go. There's a special place I want to show you on the other side of the lake, and the panorama is beyond description. You can even see some of the higher peaks from over there."
"Sounds great.
Looks like you have our lunches, so we're ready to go."
Instead of angling off to one side of the lake or the other, where Mac suspected a trail might be, Jesus headed straight for the dock. The day was bright and beautiful. The sun was warm to the skin, but not too much, and a fresh-scented breeze softly and lovingly caressed their faces. Mac next assumed that they would be taking one of the canoes nestled against the dock pylons, and he was surprised when Jesus didn't hesitate as he passed the third and last of them, heading directly for the end of the pier. Reaching the end of the dock, he turned to Mac and grinned.
"After you."
You're kidding, right?
I thought we were going for a walk, not a swim."
"We are. I just thought going across the lake would take less time than going around it."
"I'm not that great a swimmer, and besides, the water looks pretty damn cold."
He suddenly realized what he had said and felt his face flush.
"I mean, darn, pretty darn cold."
He looked up at Jesus with a frozen grimace on his face, but the other man seemed to be actually enjoying Mac's discomfort.
Now, we both know that you are a very capable swimmer, once a lifeguard, if I remember right. And the water is cold, and it's deep. But I'm not talking about swimming. I want to walk across with you. What Jesus had been suggesting, Mac finally allowed into his consciousness. He was talking about walking across on the water. Jesus anticipated his hesitation. Come on, Mac. If Peter can do it. Mac laughed, more out of nerves than anything. To be sure, he asked one more time. You want me to walk on the water to the other side? That is what you're saying, right? You're a quick one, Mac. Nobody gonna slide anything past you, that's for sure. Come on, it's fun. Mac walked to the edge of the dock and looked down. The water lapped only about a foot below where he stood, but it might as well have been 100 feet. The distance looked enormous. To dive in would have been easy. He'd have done that 1,000 times, but how do you step off a dock onto water? Do you jump as if you're landing on concrete, or do you step over the edge like you're getting out of a boat? He looked back at Jesus, who was still chuckling. Peter had the same problem. How to get out of the boat? It's just like stepping off a 1-foot-high stair. Nothing to it.
Will my feet get wet?
Of course. Water is still wet. Again, Mac looked down at the water and back at Jesus.
Then why is this so hard for me?
Tell me what you're afraid of, Mac.
Well, let me see. What am I afraid of? Well, I'm afraid of looking like an idiot. I'm afraid that you are making fun of me and that I will sink like a rock. I imagine that...
Exactly. You imagine. Such a powerful ability, the imagination. That power alone makes you so like us. But without wisdom, imagination is a cruel taskmaster. If I may prove my case, do you think humans were designed to live in the present, or the past, or the future?
Well, I think the most obvious answer is that we were designed to live in the present.
Is that wrong?
Relax, Mac. This is not a test. It's a conversation.
You are exactly correct, by the way. But now tell me, where do you spend most of your time in your mind, in your imagination? In the present, in the past, or in the future? Mac thought for a moment before answering.
I suppose I would have to say that I spend very little time in the present. For me, I spend a big piece in the past, but most of the rest of the time I'm trying to figure out the future.
Not unlike most people. When I dwell with you, I do so in the present. I live in the present, not the past, although much can be remembered and learned by looking back, but only for a visit, not an extended stay. And for sure, I do not dwell in the future you visualize or imagine. Mac, do you realize that your imagination of the future, which is almost always dictated by fear of some kind, rarely, if ever, pictures me there with you? Again, Mac stopped and thought. It was true. He spent a lot of time fretting and worrying about the future, and in his imaginations, it was usually pretty gloomy and depressing, if not outright horrible. And Jesus was also correct in saying that in Mac's imaginations of the future, God was always absent. Why do I do that? It is your desperate attempt to get some control over something you can't. It is impossible for you to take power over the future because it isn't even real, nor will it ever be real. You try and play God, imagining the evil that you fear becoming reality, and then you try and make plans and contingencies to avoid what you fear.
Yeah, that's basically what Sarayu was saying. So why do I have so much fear in my life?
Because you don't believe. You don't know that we love you. The person who lives by their fears will not find freedom in my love. I'm not talking about rational fears regarding legitimate dangers, but imagined fears, and especially the projection of those into the future. To the degree that those fears have a place in your life, you neither believe I am good, nor know deep in your heart that I love you. You sing about it, you talk about it, but you don't know it. Mac looked down once more at the water and breathed a huge sigh of the soul.
I have so far to go.
Only about 1 foot, looks to me. Jesus placed his hand on Mac's shoulder.
It was all he needed, and Mac stepped off the dock. In order to try and see the water as solid and not be deterred by its motion, he looked up at the far shore and held the lunch bags high, just in case. The landing was softer than he had thought it would be. His shoes were instantly wet, but the water did not come up even to his ankles. The lake was still moving all around him, and he almost lost his balance because of it. It was strange. Looking down, it seemed that his feet were on something solid but invisible. He turned to find Jesus standing next to him, holding his own shoes and socks in one hand and smiling. "We always take off our shoes and socks before we do this." Max shook his head, laughing, as he sat back on the edge of the dock. "I think I will anyway." He took them off, wrung out his socks, and then rolled up his pant legs just to be sure. They started off with footwear and lunch bags in hand and walked toward the opposite shore, about a half-mile distant. The water felt cool and refreshing and sent chills up his spine. Walking on the water with Jesus seemed like the most natural way to cross a lake, and Mac was grinning ear to ear just thinking about what he was doing. He would occasionally look down to see if he could see any lake trout. "This is utterly ridiculous and impossible, you know." "Of course." They rapidly reached the far shore, and Mac could hear the sound of rushing water growing louder, but he couldn't see its source. 20 yards from the shore, he stopped. To their left, and behind a high rock ridge, he could see it, a beautiful waterfall spilling over a cliff's edge and dropping at least 100 feet into a pool at the canyon floor. There it became a large creek that probably joined the lake beyond where Mac could see. Between them and the waterfall was an expanse of mountain meadow, filled with blooming wildflowers haphazardly strewn and seeded by the wind. It was all stunning, and Mac stood for a moment breathing it in. An image of Missy flashed in his mind, but didn't settle. A pebbled beach awaited their approach, and behind it a backdrop of rich and dense forest rose up to the base of a mountain, crested by the whiteness of freshly fallen snow. Slightly to their left, at the end of a small clearing and just to the other side of a small babbling brook, a trail disappeared quickly into the wooded darkness. Max stepped off of the water and onto the small rocks, gingerly making his way toward a log that had fallen. There he sat down and again wrung out his socks, placing them in his shoes to dry in the near noon sun. Only then did he look up and across the lake. The beauty was staggering. He could make out the shack, where smoke leisurely rose from the red brick chimney as it nestled against the greens of the orchard and forest. But dwarfing it all was a massive range of mountains that hovered above and behind, like sentinels standing guard. Max simply sat, Jesus next to him, and inhaled the visual symphony. "You do great work."
"Thank you, Mac. And you've seen so little. For now, most of what exists in the universe will only be seen and enjoyed by me, like special canvases in the back of an artist's studio. But one day... And can you imagine the scene if the Earth was not at war, striving so hard just to survive?"
"And you mean what, exactly?"
"Our Earth is like a child who has grown up without parents, having no one to guide and direct her." As Jesus spoke, his voice intensified in subdued anguish. "Some have attempted to help her, but most have simply tried to use her. Humans, who have been given the task to lovingly steer the world, instead plunder her with no consideration, other than their immediate needs. And they give little thought for their own children, who will inherit their lack of love. So they use her and abuse her with little consideration, and then, when she shudders or blows her breath, they are offended and raise their fist at God."
"You're an ecologist? This blue-green ball in black space, filled with beauty even now, battered and abused and lovely? I know that song. You must care deeply about the creation."
"Well, this blue-green ball in black space belongs to me." After a moment, they opened their lunches together. Papa had filled the sacks with sandwiches and treats, and both ate heartily. Mac munched on something that he liked, but couldn't quite decide if it was animal or vegetable. He thought it might be better not to ask.
"So,
Why don't you fix it?
Mac munched on his sandwich.
The earth, I mean.
Because we gave it to you.
Can't you take it back?
Of course we could, but then the story would end before it was consummated.
Mac gave Jesus a blank look. Have you noticed that even though you call me Lord and King, I have never really acted in that capacity with you? I've never taken control of your choices or forced you to do anything, even when what you were about to do was destructive or hurtful to yourself and others.
Mac looked back at the lake before responding. I would have preferred that you did take control at times. It would have saved me and people I care about a lot of pain.
To force my will on you is exactly what love does not do. Genuine relationships are marked by submission, even when your choices are not helpful or healthy. That's the beauty you see in my relationship with Abba and Sarayu. We are, indeed, submitted to one another, and have always been so, and always will be. Papa is as much submitted to me as I to him, or Sarayu to me, or Papa to her. Submission is not about authority, and it is not obedience. It is all about relationships of love and respect. In fact, we are submitted to you in the same way.
Well, how can that be? Why would the God of the universe want to be submitted to me?
Because we want you to join us in our circle of relationship. I don't want slaves to my will. I want brothers and sisters who will share life with me.
And that's how you want us to love each other, I suppose. I mean, between husbands and wives, parents and children. I guess in any relationship.
Exactly. When I am your life, submission is the most natural expression of my character and nature, and it will be the most natural expression of your new nature within relationships.
And all I wanted was a God who will fix everything so no one gets hurt. But I'm not very good at relationship stuff, not like Nan.
Jesus finished the last bite of his sandwich and, closing his lunch bag, placed it down next to him on the log. He wiped off a couple crumbs that still adhered to his mustache and short beard, then grabbing a nearby stick, he began to doodle in the sand as he continued.
That's because, like most men, you find what you think of as fulfillment in your achievements. And Nan, like most women, find it in relationships. It's more naturally her language.
Jesus paused to watch an osprey dive into the lake not 50 feet from them and slowly take flight again, talons gripping a large lake trout still struggling to escape.
Does that mean I'm hopeless? I really want what the three of you share, but I have no idea how to get there.
There's a lot in your way right now, Mac, but you don't have to keep living with it.
I know that's truer now that Missy's gone, but it has never been easy for me.
You're not just dealing with Missy's murder. There's a larger twisting that makes sharing life with us difficult. The world is broken because in Eden you abandon relationship with us to assert your own independence. Most men have expressed it by turning to the work of their hands and the sweat of their brow to find their identity, value, and security. By choosing to declare what's good and evil, you seek to determine your own destiny. It was this turning that has caused so much pain.
Jesus braced himself with a stick to stand and paused while Mac finished his last bite and stood to join him. Together they began walking along the lakeshore.
But that isn't all. The woman's desire, and the word is actually her turning, so the woman's turning was not to the works of her hands, but to the man. And his response was to rule over her, to take power over her, to become the ruler. Before the choosing, she found her identity, her security, and her understanding of good and evil only in me, as did man.
No wonder I feel like a failure with Nan. I can't seem to be that for her.
You weren't made to be. And in trying, you'll only be playing God.
Mac reached down, picked up a flat stone, and skipped it across the lake.
Is there any way out of this?
It is so simple, but never easy for you. By returning.
by turning back to me, by giving up your ways of power and manipulation, and just come back to me. Women in general will find it difficult to turn from a man and stop demanding that he meets their needs, provides security and protects their identity, and return to me. Men in general find it very hard to turn from the works of their hands, their own quests for power and security and significance, and return to me. I've always wondered why men have been in charge. Males seem to be the cause of so much of the pain in the world. They account for most of the crime, and many of those are perpetrated against women and children.
Jesus picked up a stone and skipped it. Women turn from us to another relationship, while men turn to themselves and the ground. The world, in many ways, would be a much calmer and gentler place if women ruled. There would have been far fewer children sacrificed to the gods of greed and power.
Then they would have fulfilled that role better.
Better, maybe, but it still wouldn't have been enough. Power in the hands of independent humans, be they men or women, does corrupt. Mac, don't you see how filling roles is the opposite of relationship? We want male and female to be counterparts, face-to-face equals, each unique and different, distinctive in gender, but complementary, and each empowered uniquely by Sarayu, from whom all true power and authority originates. Remember, I am not about performance and fitting into man-made structures. I am about being. As you grow in relationship with me, what you do will simply reflect who you really are.
But you came in the form of a man. Doesn't that say something?
Yes, but not what many have assumed. I came as a man to complete a wonderful picture in how we made you. From the first day, we hid the woman within the man, so that at the right time, we could remove her from within him. We didn't create man to live alone. She was purposed from the beginning. By taking her out of him, he birthed her in a sense. We created a circle of relationship like our own, but for humans. She out of him, and now all the males, including me, birthed through her, and all originating or birthed from God.
Max stopped mid-throw. Oh, I get it. If the female had been created first, there would have been no circle of relationship, and thus no possibility of a fully equal face-to-face relationship between the male and female, right?
Exactly right, Max. Our desire was to create a being that had a fully equal and powerful counterpart, the male and the female. But your independence, with its quest for power and fulfillment, actually destroys the relationship your heart longs for.
There it is again, Max said,
sifting through the rocks to find the flattest stone.
It always comes back to power and how opposite that is from the relationship you have with the other two. I'd love to experience that. With you and with Nan.
That's why we're here.
I wish she were too.
Oh, what could have been?
Mac had no idea what he meant.
They were quiet for a few minutes, except for some grunting as rocks were thrown and the sounds they made skipping across the water. Jesus stopped just as he was about to throw a rock.
One last thing that I want you to remember about this conversation, Mac, before you go.
He tossed the rock. Mac looked up surprised.
Before I go,
Jesus ignored his question. Mac, just like love, submission is not something that you can do, especially not on your own. Apart from my life inside of you, you can't submit to Nan or your children or anyone else in your life, including Papa.
You mean that I can't just ask, what would Jesus do?
Good intentions. Bad idea. Let me know how it works for you, if that's the way you choose to go.
Seriously, my life was not meant to be an example to copy. Being my follower is not trying to be like Jesus. It means for your independence to be killed. I came to give you life, real life, my life. We will come and live our life inside of you, so that you begin to see with our eyes, and hear with our ears, and touch with our hands, and think like we do. But we will never force that union on you.
If you want to do your own thing, have at it. Time is on our side.
This must be the dying daily that Saryu was talking about.
Speaking of time, you have an engagement.
Jesus turned and pointed at the path that led into the forest at the end of the clearing.
Follow that path and enter where it ends.
I'll wait for you here.
As much as he wanted to, Mac knew that it would be no use to try and continue the conversation. In thoughtful silence, he put on his socks and shoes. They were not totally dry by this time, but not too uncomfortable. Standing up without another word, he squished his way toward the end of the beach, stopped for a minute to look once more at the waterfall, jumped over the little brook, and entered the woods down a well-maintained and marked path.
Here comes the judge. Whoever undertakes to set himself up as a judge of truth and knowledge is shipwrecked by the laughter of the gods. Albert Einstein. O, my soul, be prepared to meet him who knows how to ask questions. T.S. Eliot.
Mac followed the trail that wound past the waterfall away from the lake and through a dense patch of cedar trees. It took less than 5 minutes to reach an impasse. The path took him directly to a rock face, the faint outline of a door barely visible on the surface. Obviously, he was meant to enter, so he hesitantly reached out and pushed. His hand simply penetrated the wall as if it wasn't there. Mac continued to move cautiously forward until his entire body passed through what appeared to be the solid stone exterior of the mountain. It was thick black within, and he could see nothing. Taking a deep breath, and with his hands outstretched in front of him, he ventured a couple small steps into the inky darkness and stopped. Fear seized him as he tried to breathe, unsure whether or not to continue. As his stomach clenched, he felt it again. The great sadness settling on his shoulders with its full weight, almost suffocating him. He desperately wanted to back out into the light, but in the end, he believed that Jesus would not have sent him in here without a good purpose. He pressed in farther. Slowly his eyes recovered from the shock of moving from daylight into such deep shadows, and a minute later they adjusted enough to make out a single passageway curving off to his left. As he followed it, the brightness at the entrance behind him faded, and was replaced by a faint luminosity reflecting off the walls from somewhere ahead. Within 100 feet, the tunnel turned abruptly to his left, and Mac found himself standing at the edge of what he assumed was a huge cavern, although initially it seemed to be only vast empty space. The illusion was magnified by the only light present, a dim radiance that encircled him, but dissipated within 10 feet in every direction. Beyond that, he could see nothing, only inky blackness. The air in the place felt heavy and oppressive, with an attending chill that fought to take his breath away. He looked down and was relieved to see a faint reflection off a surface. Not the dirt and rock of the tunnel, but a floor smooth and dark, like polished mica. Bravely taking a step forward, he noticed that the light circle moved with him, illuminating a little more of the area ahead. Feeling more confident, he began to slowly and deliberately walk in the direction he had been facing, focusing on the floor, for fear it might at any moment drop away beneath him. He was so intent on watching his feet that Mac blundered into an object in front of him and almost fell. It was a chair, a comfortable-looking wooden chair in the middle of nothing. Mac quickly decided to sit and wait. As he did, the light that had assisted him continued to move forward as if he had kept walking. Directly in front of him, he now could make out an ebony desk of considerable size, completely bare. And then he jumped when the light coalesced on one spot, and he finally saw her. Behind the desk sat a tall, beautiful, olive-skinned woman with chiseled Hispanic features, clothed in a darkly colored flowing robe. She sat as straight and regal as a high court judge. She was breathtakingly stunning.
She is
beauty. Everything that sensuality strives to be but falls painfully short.
In the dim light, it was difficult to see where her face began, as her hair and robe framed and merged into her visage. Her eyes glinted and glistened as if they were portals into the vastness of the starry night sky, reflecting some unknown light source within her. He dared not speak, afraid that his voice would simply be swallowed up in the intensity of the room's focus on her. He thought, "I'm Mickey Mouse about to speak to Pavarotti." The thought made him smile. As if somehow sharing a simple delight in the grotesqueness of that image, she smiled back, and the place noticeably brightened. That was all it took for Mac to understand that he was expected and welcome here. She looked strangely familiar, as if he might have known or glimpsed her somewhere in the past, only he knew that he had never truly seen or met her before.
"May I ask, if I may, who are you?"
Mac's voice sounded every bit to him like Mickey, barely leaving an impression on the stillness of the room, but then lingering like the shadow of an echo. She ignored his query.
"Do you understand why you are here?"
Like a breeze sweeping away the dust, her voice gently ushered his question out of the room. Mac could almost feel her words rain down on his head and melt into his spine, sending delicious tingles everywhere. He shivered and decided that he never wanted to speak again. He only wanted her to talk, to speak to him, or to anyone, just as long as he could be present. But she waited.
"You know..."
His own voice was suddenly so rich and resonant that Mac was tempted to look behind him to see who had spoken. Somehow, he knew that what he had said was the truth. It simply sounded like it.
"I have no idea." He turned his gaze toward the floor. "No one told me." "Well, Mackenzie Allen Phillips..."
He looked up quickly.
"I am here to help you."
If a rainbow makes a sound, or a flower as it grows, that was the sound of her laughter. It was a shower of light, an invitation to talk, and Mac chuckled along with her, not even knowing or caring why. Soon again there was silence, and her face, though remaining soft, took on a fiery intensity, as if she was able to peer deep inside of him, past the pretenses and facades, down to the places that are rarely, if ever, spoken of.
"Today is a very serious day, with very serious consequences. Mackenzie, you are here, in part, because of your children. But you are also here for..."
"My children? What do you mean, I'm here because of my children?"
"Mackenzie, you love your children in a way that your own father was never able to love you and your sisters."
"Of course I love my children. Every parent loves their children. But why does that have anything to do with why I'm here?"
"In some sense, every parent does love their children."
She ignored his second question.
"But some parents are too broken to love them well, and others are barely able to love them at all. You should understand that. But you... you do love your children well, very well."
"I learned much of that from Nan."
"We know.
But you did learn, didn't you?"
"I suppose I did." "Among the mysteries of a broken humanity, that too is rather remarkable. To learn, to allow change. So then, Mackenzie, may I ask which of your children do you love the most?"
Max smiled inside. As the kids had come along, he had wrestled to an answer to this very question. "I don't love any one of them more than any of the others. I love each of them differently." He chose his words carefully.
"Explain that to me, Mackenzie."
"Well, each of my children is unique, and that uniqueness and special personhood calls out a unique response from me." Max settled back into his chair. "I remember after John, my first, was born. I was so captivated by the wonder of who this little life was that I actually worried about whether I would have anything left to love a second child. But when Tyler came along, it was as if he brought with him a special gift for me, a whole new capacity to love him specially. Come to think of it, it's like when Papa says she is especially fond of someone. When I think of each of my children individually, I find that I'm especially fond of each one."
Well said, Mackenzie. Her appreciation was tangible, but then she leaned forward slightly, her tone still soft, but serious. But what about when they do not behave? Or they make choices other than those you would want them to make, or they are just belligerent and rude? What about when they embarrass you in front of others? How does that affect your love for them?
It doesn't, really.
He knew that what he was saying was true, even if Katie didn't believe it sometimes.
I admit that it does affect me, and sometimes I get embarrassed or angry.
But even when they act badly, they are still my son or my daughter. They are still Josh or Kate, and they will be forever. What they do might affect my pride, but not my love for them.
She sat back, beaming. You are wise in the ways of real love, Mackenzie. So many believe that it is love that grows, but it is the knowing that grows, and love simply expands to contain it. Love is just the skin of knowing.
Mackenzie, you love your children, whom you know so well, with a wonderful and real love.
A little embarrassed at her praise, Mac looked down.
Well, thanks, but I'm not that way with very many other people. My love tends to be pretty conditional most of the time.
But it's a start, isn't it, Mackenzie? And you didn't move beyond your father's inability on your own. It was God and you together who changed you to love this way. And now you love your children much the way Father loves his.
Mac could feel his jaw involuntarily clench as he listened, and he felt the anger once more beginning to rise. What should have been a reassuring commendation seemed more like a bitter pill that he now refused to swallow. He tried to relax, to cover his emotions, but by the look in her eyes, he knew it was too late.
Something I said bother you, Mackenzie?
Her gaze now made him uncomfortable. He felt exposed.
Mackenzie, is there something you would like to say?
The silence left by her question now hung in the air. Mac struggled to retain his composure. He could hear his mother's advice ringing in his ears.
If you don't have anything nice to say, better to not speak at all.
Well, no, not really. Mackenzie, this is not a time for your mother's common sense. This is a time for honesty, for truth. You don't believe that Father loves his children very well, do you? You don't truly believe that God is good, do you?
Is Missy his child?
Of course.
Then no. I don't believe that God loves all of his children very well.
He had said it, and now his accusation echoed off whatever walls surrounded the chamber. While Max stood there, angry and ready to explode, the woman remained calm and unchanging in her demeanor. Slowly she rose from her high-back chair, moving silently behind it and motioning him toward it.
"Why don't you sit here? Is that what honesty gets you? The hot seat?"
He didn't move, simply stared back at her. She remained standing behind her chair.
"Mackenzie, earlier I began to tell you why you are here today. Not only are you here because of your children, but you are here for judgment."
As the word echoed in the chamber, panic rose inside Mac like a swelling tide, and slowly he sank into his chair. Instantly he felt guilty, as memories spilled through his mind like rats fleeing the rising flood. He gripped the arms of his chair, trying to find some balance in the onslaught of images and emotions. His failures as a human being suddenly loomed large, and in the back of his mind he could almost hear a voice intoning his catalog of sins, his dread deepening as the list grew longer and longer. He had no defense. He was lost, and he knew it.
"Mackenzie, now I understand. I'm dead, aren't I? That's why I can see Jesus and Papa, 'cause I'm dead."
He sat back and looked up into the darkness, feeling sick to his stomach.
"I can't believe it. I didn't even feel anything."
He looked at the woman who patiently watched him.
"How long have I been dead?"
"Mackenzie, I am sorry to disappoint you, but you have not yet fallen asleep in your world. And I believe that you have missed..."
Again, Mac cut her off. "I'm not dead? You mean all this is real and I'm still alive?
But I thought you said I came here for judgment.
She had a look of amusement on her face.
I did. But Mackenzie...
Judgment! And I'm not even dead?
A third time he stopped her, processing what he heard, anger replacing his panic.
This hardly seems fair.
He knew his emotions were not helping.
Does this happen to other people, getting judged, I mean, before they're even dead? What if I change? What if I do better the rest of my life? What if I repent? What then?
Is there something you wish to repent of, Mackenzie?
Mac slowly sat back down. He looked at the smooth surface of the floor and then shook his head before answering.
I wouldn't know where to begin. Quite a mess, aren't I?
Yes, you are. Mac looked up, and she smiled back.
You are a glorious, destructive mess, Mackenzie. But you are not here to repent, at least not in the way that you understand. Mackenzie, you are not here to be judged.
But I thought you said that I was...
Here for judgment? She remained cool and placid as a summer breeze as she finished his question.
I did, but you are not on trial here.
Mac took a deep breath, relieved at her words.
You will be the judge.
The knot in his stomach returned as he realized what she had said. Finally, he dropped his eyes to the chair that stood waiting for him.
What? Me?
I'd rather not. I don't have any ability to judge.
Oh, that is not true. You have already proven yourself very capable, even in our short time together. And besides,